Texas and other states, of course, are making life-threatening cuts to things like health care supplies and various other benefits. And I was reading this one article where they were giving this example of this man, and he's on a respirator, and he needed a little cloth strip for his breathing tube to protect him from infection. Now, he used to get 30 of these little strips a month from the state, but now Texas has decided he can only have 8. Now, how much does that save the state of Texas? Well, that saves $66 a month. And his mother has to wash those strips, and he has to reuse them. And then you look at, well, how much did Enron steal from the workers in Texas and the rest of the country? I mean, if this kind of thing isn't criminal, particularly in the richest country in the world, I don't know what is.
The main thing that we've got to fight against is the cult of powerlessness. You know, there's all these messages that have been put in our heads of you can't fight City Hall if you have a revolution and new leaders be just as bad as the old. You can't really change it. There is no alternative. I'm only one person. What can I do? If I hear that one more time, I'm going to puke. And what we got to do is we got to get those colonial hooks out of our heads and realize, no, we have the power. If we come together, if we realize that we are not isolated individuals, the ego is that part of you that mistakenly thinks it is separate from the rest of life. And if we get together and hook up with each other and build community and really get infused and believe in the power of people's democracy, there's nothing in this world that we can't fix. We can change this stuff, but we got to believe. We got to believe it really deeply and get out of this powerlessness cult. That's what's holding us back.
It's getting kind of dangerous to be into this consciousness. They label you a terrorist. So some are choosing ignorance, claiming that it's bliss. But that's not for this evolutionist. I choose to remain a revolutionist like Jesus Christ is to the Roman Empire. I'm one with the fire, rise with the smoke, touch the mountain peaks where Creator spoke, inspiring hope. So now I'm dreaming revolution.
This is Dreaming Revolution. I'm Mike Thornton. On this edition of DR, we get several views on the state of the economy. We hear from Democratic presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich, director of the Sacramento County Department of Human Assistance, Cheryl Davis. We'll ride along on an economic human rights bus tour. We'll get a world perspective from Dr. Kevin Danaher of Global Exchange and hear from author Brooke Hagerty as well. Dreaming Revolution is a special presentation of People's Tribune Radio and is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. When it comes to political conventional wisdom, the phrase one often hears is, it's the economy. Well, by most accounts, the economy isn't doing very well. Or perhaps more accurately, the economy is doing quite well for some and getting worse for a growing number of others. It's getting harder and harder for people to pretend that all is well or even that it's not all that bad. And as problems come home to more people, the old trick of blaming the victim is wearing as thin as the line between making a living and living in poverty. Even mainstream politicians are beginning to talk in terms that once would have been considered the realm of revolutionaries. One of those is Democratic Party presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich. He spoke in Grass Valley, California earlier this year.
We need to distinguish, as Steve Clark and I talked about 30 years ago, that the interest of the private sector and the interest of the public sector are not necessarily mutually inclusive. For example, let's take insurance companies. They have an interest in growing their profits. And when you're a health insurance company, the more money that you pay for health insurance claims, the less profit you have. The more service people get in terms of health care, the less money you make as an insurance company. The more services you give for the money people pay, the less money you make. We have created a condition in this country where 41 million Americans don't have any health insurance at all because they can't afford it, where there are tens of millions of more Americans who have health insurance, but it's inadequate. How many homes. Have we heard this discussion? Well, doctor says, got to go to the hospital. And then the next discussion is, well, are we going to be able to afford it? You know, after we get through with what the policy covers, are we going to be able to afford the hospitalization, the operation, whatever kind of medical service that would be necessary? This kind of discussion takes place in millions of homes every day in America. And yet, no one else running for President of the United States is about to say what I'm going to say right now. It is time for America to have a fully guaranteed universal health care system, Medicare for all. It is time that every one of our citizens has the opportunity for full coverage. I don't care where I'm at in America. I can look out in any audience, and there will be people in an audience who are paying $300, $400, $500, $600 a month for prescription drugs. You know this. It happens. There are people who are foregoing purchases for clothes, who are cutting back on budgets for food. In my own district, there are senior citizens who, you know, they split their pills in half to try to make a prescription last. Why is it that in the United States we pay more for the same prescription drugs that people have in other countries? We pay double what people pay in Canada. We pay triple what people pay in Italy. We pay about the same amount, triple, that people pay in France for the same medications. Why is it? Because the pharmaceutical companies have such great power over the Congress that they're able to hold on to the American people's right to health care and put confiscatory prices on the cost of prescription drugs. Right now, health care costs are crushing communities. Do you know there have been hundreds of hospitals closed? Hundreds of community hospitals closed. People don't have access that they used to have. All of this talk about closing down capacity in health care is really more than anything about increasing the profitability of major insurers, and it's making it difficult for smaller community hospitals to be able to survive. I know because in Cleveland, Ohio, 300 and more hospitals were closed over a period of about 5 years in the United States. Two hospitals were not in Cleveland. Because in Cleveland, what we did, we rallied the community around what we believe, and I know what everyone believes, is a basic right to health care. We need to take a different approach towards government, one that appeals to people's practical aspirations. And our practical aspirations are for health care, but they're also for jobs. Now let's talk about unemployment for a moment. There are, by all statistical accounts, 8.8 million people currently unemployed. But we know there are many people who have stopped looking for work. They're not even counted anymore. We also know there are millions more who are working part-time who want a full-time job and can't find one. We know that this government has not taken care to make addressing the unemployment problem as urgent as it makes the challenge of addressing the interest rate. As a matter of fact, the Federal Reserve ought to have the responsibility of doing both, not just guiding the interest rates to make sure that people have access to capital at a fair rate, but also making sure that the other side of the equation in our economy, which relates directly to people's productive capacity, is addressed through having programs towards creating a full employment economy. Now, let me tell you what I mean about that. Years ago, legislation was passed in the House of Representatives called the Humphrey-Hawkins Bill. And that bill said that unemployment should never go above 4%. Look at where we are right now, 6.6%. Unemployment keeps climbing, climbing, and climbing. We need to address some of the root causes of unemployment in this country. And I'm going to talk to you about it right now. One of the major causes of unemployment in this country is our trade policies, which have not adequately regarded the impact of trade agreements on America's manufacturing base and on a number of American industries and small businesses. We're approaching a $500 billion trade deficit. That trade deficit undermines our ability to be able to address other issues in our economy, because what's happening is we have to borrow money to paper over the deficit. Soon, we'll be selling assets to be able to cover the deficits in trade. We could foresee a time in our country's future where our children, if not ourselves, will be looking at the kind of structural adjustment remedies that the International Monetary Fund has brought to South American countries: lower wages, cancel out social welfare benefits, increase food prices in order for a nation to have the money to pay off its loans. Now, let me tell you what I think needs to be done. You know, coming from Cleveland, Ohio, I'm familiar with how our trade policies have undermined steel, automotive, and aerospace, which have been the cornerstone of our economy nationally for generations. Cleveland has struggled mightily to hold on to its steel mill. We rallied the community again in Cleveland. While 30 steel mills were being closed nationally, we came together, again going into bankruptcy court, and challenged the efforts of a steel monopoly to close our steel mills. And we saved a steel mill in Cleveland. But yet thousands of jobs have been lost in my own community, because what's happened is that trade agreements have made it easy to move jobs out of this country, and the corporations are in search of lower wages, no benefits. They're looking for places where workers don't have any rights. They're looking for places where workers don't have the right to organize, the right to bargain collectively. They don't have the right to strike. They're looking for places where they have child labor, where people can be forced to work 16 hours a day for wages next to nothing. They're looking for places where waterways are turned into sewers and where the air is just plumes and plumes of toxic smoke. Because those are all factors that relate to affecting profitability. I have met with families where the breadwinner has lost his or her job because the job moved south or moved off the continent. And if you're 50 years old, 55 years old, where do you go? We have so many communities that have been broken by trade agreements that have never worked for the American people, and frankly don't work for people in Mexico and other countries, because they're faced with the same dilemma of depressed wages. They've worked only for global corporations: electric systems, water systems, sewer systems, public parks, public schools, all represent the wealth of a community. They're public rights. They belong to us. That's part of what having a community is about, to share in these facilities. The WTO is moving towards a new and very dangerous phase of permitting global water corporations to insist that the existence of municipally owned water systems presents an unfair competitive advantage to the global water companies. Right. So what of home rule? What of self-determination at the most essential level of government we come in contact with all the time? In our neighborhoods, in our communities.
What's happening in many of our communities is a crying shame. As we go to production, the California legislature is on the verge of passing a state budget, 44 days late and billions of dollars in the red. And while what's happening in the so-called Golden State may be bigger in scale, most states across the country are starting to drown in red ink. President Bush has announced the largest federal budget deficit in history, and the unemployment rate is the highest it's been in at least a decade. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan is talking about a jobless recovery, and it doesn't take an economist to know what that means. Back in California, politicians like Senate Pro Tem John Burton say that the budget will not be balanced on the backs of the poor and most needy. And as always, that's exactly what's happening. Prior to the state budget passing, we talked with Cheryl Davis, who's the director of Sacramento's Department of Human Assistance, and she told us that it is the needy, the young and the old, that will suffer the worst.
We're primarily the public assistance department, or what used to be called the welfare department, but we also have a lot of community services. We're responsible for our county's homeless programs, the senior nutrition services, senior volunteer programs, and veteran services.
So we're really talking about a group of programs that really serve the neediest people in our communities and the most vulnerable in many respects.
No, that's very accurate. You know, we really consider ourselves like the safety net programs of our community.
As I understand it, the budget deficit is shredding the safety net in Sacramento. Is that an accurate depiction?
Yes, that's very accurate. It's very, very scary for us. We've spent the past several years really being able to build that up and have a really nice complement of services throughout our community. And with the budget reductions, we are just wholesale cutting. We're not even trimming. It's beyond trimming, just cutting off wholesale programs to seniors and to young people.
What kind of budget deficit are you facing? We're talking, I mean, multiple millions of dollars here.
Yes, we're talking about $56 million. Problem with my department alone. The county of Sacramento has a $102 million budget deficit. So we're over half the county's problem just in my department alone. A major part of our cuts, especially for the youth programs, came from a lack of incentive funds planned for next year. Incentive funds were those that the welfare department got for getting so many people to work under welfare reform. And we've been very successful in Sacramento County, and we had those incentive funds, about $11 million this year, and we chose to invest them back in our young people so that they can stay in school. It was that kind of program, improve their attendance, improve their scores, improve their grades, a lot of after-school care programs and youth employment programs as a way to prevent them from ever having to come on welfare. So it was a real good prevention there for us.
In addition to youth programs, I thought I also saw domestic violence programs being cut, other types of welfare-to-work programs, I believe to one degree or another perhaps some alcohol abuse programs and other things. I mean, this is simply not just programs for young people, correct?
That's correct. That was just one area. And you hit all the rest, a lot of welfare-to-work programs, job retention services that once we get someone a job to help them keep the job so they don't come back on welfare. Several programs had to do with supporting our families in life skills, preventing, as you said, the domestic violence, things like that. And what wasn't on the list are cuts to our senior nutrition services where we may not be able to serve meals to 500 seniors. And our homeless programs, the budget cuts, that's a local problem. The lack of funds at the county level could mean we have to cut almost 40% of our homeless shelter beds.
Obviously, this isn't anything you're saying. It's something I'm saying. I know that just recently a number of big brokerage houses in New York have cut a deal with Attorney General Elliot Spitzer there to pay a fine that has to do with their fraudulent activities in hyping stock. And, a lot of that has led to the stock market, I'm not going to call it a crash in the classical sense of the term, but certainly a lot of the problems and the decrease in stock market value that we've seen. I'm feeling a little bit less than generous to some of these big brokerage firms back east, as many poor people apparently are going to suffer in large part due to what appears to be some of their actions. I'm saying that. You're not saying that. Let me ask you this, because one of the things that we hear, and we do hear this put forth as policy, particularly on the national level, you know, that government should be moving away from these kinds of services anyway. These kinds of services should be provided by charitable organizations, religious organizations. Are charitable and or religious organizations in Sacramento going to be able to deal with the fallout from this, in your opinion?
No, and they have told us so. We're going to be removing $56 million from services in our community. I don't think we can expect our faith community or our private organizations to step up and fill that gap. That's a horrendous gap to fill. And we contract with many of those faith organizations and community-based organizations, and we know our money helps leverage other private money, but they have not been able to do it alone on private donations and fundraising and things like that. It really has to be a partnership, and I know they're trying to move away from government participating, but We see our community-based organizations struggle daily to make ends meet without government support of what they're trying to do.
What happens? Well, let me ask you this. How many people in general do you think this is going to affect? I'm talking about on-the-ground human beings.
Well, you know, just in our youth development contracts alone, we were serving 12,000 young people a year. So come July 1, we'll have 12,000 young people who won't have an after-school activity or support at school. We know as a result of cutting these contracts, about 260 staff in our community who were with these community organizations will be laid off. And we also know that probably another 6,000 families had been receiving support through some of these contracts with life skills and keeping their jobs and things like that and advancing in their careers. So it's a substantial amount of folks.
Let me ask you this, and it may or may not be a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
And that is, you know, when you're not being Cheryl Davis, director of the Sacramento County Department of Human Assistance, and you're just being Cheryl Davis, human being,
mm-hmm.
What is it that you think about and feel when you think about and feel about this situation that's going on?
That it's not fair. That it's how you started out saying, you know, we're the neediest of our needy are being harmed by this. And Cheryl Davis, the human being, has some of the same feelings you have about some of the corporate scandals and the unfairness of all that. And that's then when I come back to work, I try to make sure we try to level that playing field as best we can for those folks who can't advocate for themselves or don't have the political power to advocate for themselves.
But a growing number of poor people and their advocates aren't just sitting around waiting for people like Cheryl Davis or politicians to help them. In the fall of 2002, WEAP, the Women's Economic Agenda Project, headquartered in Oakland, California, conducted a Poor People's Human Rights Bus Tour throughout the northern part of the state. The group wanted to help organize poor people, both those working and not working, as well as collect documentation to show that the conditions faced by many of these people are direct violations of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. A video was made chronicling the bus tour, and this is what it sounds like.
My name is Andre Dawkins, and I'm on this bus because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And those who have don't see that those who don't have need.
I'm personally on the bus today simply because I'm tired of watching women like myself, mothers like myself, having to struggle and fight to find housing for my children.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to go to work every day. I mean, to work hard. And not be able to house your family.
We out to try to get some help.
Yeah.
And we're gonna get it.
This is a spiritual warfare thing, what we're doing.
I came on this trip to make a difference.
Black people are dying.
This is about recognizing that we cannot do this alone.
We have set up a number of economic human rights communities all over California.
I got to fight for our rights, and this is the time.
We wake up in the morning, I said, Mama, if you don't take me, I'll walk by myself.
All right.
So I think we should get together as much as we can and bring about change.
We're here today as a part of a growing, budding movement that says poverty is a human rights violation, and we're putting it on the map in the state of California.
Yeah.
Everybody ready for that?
Yeah.
We are here from Oakland today, but we're really here traveling with many people to join up and show that we are a part of this country. We are talking, we're teaching about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 23, 25, and 26, which state that we have the right to just a decent lifestyle.
Rights was written on paper 50 years ago. We live in a better society today, economically, than they did 50 years ago. And it ain't going to change unless we take a stand and say, eliminate poverty.
Economic human rights has got to be on the tongues of all of us and of every policymaker throughout this state and across this great country.
So you be a part of the movement with the solution, or you be a part of the movement with the problem or complaint. Welfare from the end in 2002.
Yes. We're not talking about pity, sisters and brothers. We're talking about power.
Yes.
You know what power means?
Yes.
It means the ability to set priorities and establish policies. But it's our movement. We've got to shape it.
I'll go with you now, tomorrow, next day. But let me go do my work and I'll come back with you. I'll go to D.C. I'll go anywhere with you. Chicago, Detroit, no matter to me. I've been there, done that, and I will go in the Capitol. We shut them down.
Shut them down.
So we're voting to you, man. We're voting now.
So I think we should get together as much as we can and bring about change.
This crisis is affecting more than just the people on the bottom. I think in the bus tour you're seeing people that can talk from the heart and from experience about what it is to feel poverty, what it is to be thinking how you're going to make it, where's your next roof going to be, or your next hot meal. But I'm seeing people that previously were doing real well, but the thing is they got sick. I mean, they found out that insurance didn't cover everything. And that's a situation that's happening all over this country.
This is another beautiful morning on a road, on a mission. I will not rest until poverty is eliminated. I may feel tired, but that don't mean nothing, because I can't stop, I won't stop. I don't stop and I won't quit until it's eliminated. This is another beautiful day. It's going to be cold, but it's all right, because we have a big family and we're going to stay warm and we're going to go out there and fight. That's the real point. It's not about me, it's about our people.
I just moved here from Michigan to California, and I moved here with the understanding that I would be working at a corporation that I worked for back in Michigan, and I understand that the cost of living was higher here, and so I thought I would be making more and actually would be taking a pay cut.
That is a form of the living wage ordinance we're trying to get in effect. That
$5.15 per hour if that's what their minimum wage status is. It's not enough money to pay for people to go out for child care.
I'm a young mother and I have 2 children to feed, and and we don't even have a home right now. And so right now my family's living in our van.
Wow.
No heat.
Yeah.
I haven't been on any sort of state aid, you know, since my son, who's 4 now, was a baby. And I don't want to get any more public assistance because I feel, you know, if I work hard enough, then I can support myself and my family. See, here's the thing about that. They don't tell everybody.
Yeah, I know.
And people, it's hard to find out that information because nobody's telling nobody nothing.
How you doing, sister? We got some information for you. We're here for the Freedom Bus Ride for People's Economic Human Rights. Here's some literature. And here's a violation form. I said, what is all this? This is for poor people having some rights, working together.
That's under Article 25. We're trying to adopt a living wage.
We've been making $5.75 for damn near 4 or 5 years. Why they can't just...
Living wage, that's part of the 20.
It's supposed to take effect in January, but that should have been going on. You know what I'm saying? We barely making ends meet.
It's like she's on welfare or whatever, and she's supposed to get her check on the 8th, but she still hasn't even got it. So we like, what we're going to do, because it's around Thanksgiving. You know?
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, I don't know what to do. We don't know what to do.
Well, we have our internet addresses right there. You can see where we've been so far. Go up on the internet, check that out. You can also check out Kensington Welfare Rights Union. We will be at a hearing right here, a human rights hearing tonight at the Toberman Settlement House.
This is exciting. Well, every place we've gone, we tried to do documentation. We just told them about this meeting when we met them at 3 o'clock or something. And we told them to come on over, told them today the work that you all were doing. We know that people want to make a difference, and this is a significant time, and especially when you talk about linking people on public assistance and the issues of working poor people.
Yeah, I'm not sure as in how to get this started, so I'm willing to talk to whoever, but I'm definitely ready to commit to educate.
There's a lot of people like us out there.
That's right. All together, we have to know that we're not alone.
Right.
So this is why we're waking people up on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. These articles here state that we, every American, are
by yourself, you ain't got nothing going on.
That's what we're doing.
We planted the seeds and some things, but they don't want to enjoy the harvest.
You're listening to Dreaming Revolution, a special presentation of People's Tribune Radio. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. You can get more information about the League of Revolutionaries for a New America by calling 1-800-691-6888 or on the internet, www.lrna.org. In mid-September, the World Trade Organization, or the WTO, will hold its 5th ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico. The WTO claims that through its process of corporate globalization, or neoliberalism as it's known in much of the world, all economic boats will be lifted, and the abject poverty that billions of people on the planet experience on a daily basis will, to one degree or another, be ameliorated. Critics claim that the World Trade Organization is a new world order of exploitation that allows for the rape of the planet and the privatization of essential commodities and services like water, education, and health care. The WTO helps promote corporate farming techniques and genetic engineering that many say are further endangering the earth while marginalizing the poor and subsistence farmers, especially in the global south, for the profit of the wealthy, mostly of the global north. In 1999, thousands of activists came to Seattle, Washington to protest the WTO, and many people are expecting as big or bigger a turnout in Cancun. When it comes to the economy, it must now be looked at in a global context. Dr. Kevin Danaher is the co-founder and director of public education for the San Francisco-based Global Exchange.
We got this problem here, and that is we are 4.5% of the world's population consuming about 25% of the world's resources. That cannot continue. That's what all this Bush war agenda is all about, is maintaining that inequality. So if we're going to make a transition from being an empire to being just a nation and a community of nations and a good neighbor, it's going to depend on the American people being educated and knowing what our real role is in the world and why it is so many people hate us around the world. And what we find in our work around the world is that most people can distinguish between U.S. government policies and the American people, but unfortunately there are a lot of people who don't, and there's a lot of people in this country who don't. They conflate the two. So we end up getting lumped in with Bush. Fundamentally, what we're about is about educating people about democracy. Democracy means get off the couch, rediscover your spine, get out there in the streets, and let's change it. Let's reclaim our country from the corporations that took it away from us.
Dr. Danaher, let me ask you this, because when we're talking about this whole issue of globalization, I mean, these words get thrown around. In other parts of the world, it's referred to as neoliberalism. I mean, what are we really talking about here, and what effect is this really having on the planet and its people?
Yeah. If you go back to end of World War II, there was one country that was up and standing, industrial, robust, military strong. That was the United States. All the other countries were basically wiped out. They were on their backsides. So there was a retreat from the Third World of all those French colonies, Japanese colonies, British colonies, et cetera. And the U.S. moved into that. U.S. corporations and the U.S. military moved into that political and economic vacuum. It made it easy for U.S. transnational corporations to start moving their factories out of the United States to those places where you can pay people a dollar a day, there's no trade unions, there's no environmental regulations, and it's more profitable for them. But they want to sell the stuff back here because this is where the money is, this is where the market is, you know, us sucker consumers. So everybody thinks, oh, we're getting a great deal because we can go to Walmart, we can get $20 sneakers that were made in sweatshops in China where the workers were paid a dollar a day. But if you look at what's gone on, they've undermined our economy, not just with the jobs being taken away, but the tax base, and that's the key thing that people miss. If you look at the first 25 years of a thing called GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, it is now enforced by the WTO, the World Trade Organization. The first 25 years of that organization, they focused on one thing, and that was lowering taxes on transnational corporations to make it easier for them to move their capital around and move goods around without paying taxes. But tax changes are always redistributive. If you lower taxes on one group, you got to raise them on the rest. So what they did was they shifted the tax burden from the biggest, richest corporations, the ones that can operate globally, to the mom-and-pop small business sector and to us, the working class. So you got a massive shift in the distribution of who pays the taxes. That did several things. One, it bankrupted our government. The federal government is now $6 trillion with a T, $6 trillion in debt. That's three times the size of all third world government debt combined. It forced even liberals to cut social programs because they say, oh, we got this huge debt, you know, we got to cut programs. But it shifted a lot of wealth to the corporations so they could do mergers and acquisitions and pay their CEOs $100 million a year. So the inequality in the U.S. now is actually worse than countries like India, right, that we look at and say, oh, look at that inequality. No, the inequality in the United States is actually worse. So we had a massive shift, not only of wealth, but also of political power to these huge corporations. Who runs our government? Who controls our government? It's big corporations. Who controls the mass media, the public airwaves? It's supposed to be our property. It's taken over by big corporations. And I would add the college university system. If you take the photographs of the regents and trustees of most of our colleges, it's the same people. So this country was founded on the principle of government of the people, by the people, for the people. Sovereignty, ultimate political power, is supposed to reside in us, we the people. And instead it's been taken over by these corporations. So if we get people to focus on the word democracy, which comes from two Greek roots meaning people rule, demos kratos, people rule, we can get back to or advance to a real democracy, not a phony corporate money democracy, but a real popular democracy where more than 50% of the public actually votes you know, that's in presidential elections. In the off-year elections, you get 20-30% voting. We should be ashamed. We should really be ashamed. We're going around bombing countries, invading countries, saying we're going to bring you democracy. And most of the people in the United States don't even bother to vote. And they don't even bother to exercise their rights of free speech. So we got a severe, severe contradiction here that we, the American people, we have to take it on ourselves to fix this. The politicians, the leaders in Washington, they're not going to do it for us. It's up to us.
Our guest is Dr. Kevin Danaher, co-founder and director of public education at Global Exchange. Well, Dr. Danaher, I think it's really important to point out that this globalization effort, this corporate globalization effort, because I want to delineate that from a people's globalization movement, which I hope we'll talk about in a little bit. I mean, this is a bipartisan effort. This is not a Republican agenda or a Democratic agenda. They've all been involved in this for many, many years. But it seems like the Bush administration is really stepping this up. I mean, from the way you were describing it, when I think now about this recent alleged tax cut, you know, it's more of the same, but it seems to be intensifying. I mean, am I wrong in that?
Yeah, what these guys want to do is they want to bankrupt government. Government is the only institution that we, the people, can use to get control over the big corporations. These guys can be seen as rented politicians. They work for the big corporations that fund their huge campaigns and give them these fat checks. So their whole thing, if you look at this, I hesitate to call it conservative, this far-right ideology about government is bad, get the government out of the way. Well, government is us. Government is supposed to be we the people. It's not some foreign alien thing. It's supposed to be controlled, be of, by, and for the people. But they put out this ideology, oh, get the government out of the way. Government's bad. It's corrupt. It's inefficient. It can't do anything right. Because if you scale down the size and power of government, that privatizes the society that puts everything into the hands of the corporations. That's what the World Trade Organization is all about. It's the last level of government development. It's global government. They're writing a constitution for the entire planet, and the only people seated at the table are corporate trade lawyers. And because transnational corporations are not rooted in place, they want to be able to come into any area, your town, my town, and take out wealth. It's a colonial model. Whereas we, both working class people and small business people, we are rooted in place. So the very fact of the corporation's economic strength, that they're not rooted in place, that's their political weakness. Because if we create local green economy networks that bring together the solar energy companies, the wind energy companies, the organic farmers, the environmentalists, the trade unions, the church groups, the human rights groups, and we get together and we say, look, let's trap wealth in the local economy. Let's shop locally. Let's buy locally. When our city government is going to buy uniforms for the police, we should have them be organic cotton. It should be grown locally. All that kind of policy based on strengthening the local green economy, that's obviously in our own self-interest, and that's how we're going to stop the WTO. Because you're not going to get some organization based in Geneva come into small communities and tell people you can't run your own affairs. So that's a fight. Bring it on. Let's have it, because we'll win.
A lot of times, and I think this is a real function of the corporate media, is to make people who oppose the ruling paradigm, if you will, to try and make those people feel like they're alone, they're isolated, they're kind of weird and, you know, thinking, you know, outside the norm or the mainstream. We saw that myth shattered in Seattle, I believe.
Yeah.
And the, you know, there really is a global movement of people's globalization going on,
and it's getting stronger every day. I mean, you can think of it in these ways. There's two, you know, people say globalization like it's a unified phenomenon. There's really two globalizations. There's the elite globalization of the corporations, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, and their value package is money values, violence, God is on our side. The other is people's globalization that's coming up from the grassroots. It's the anti-sweatshop movement. It's the fair trade movement. It's the organic agriculture movement, the slow food movement, the women's movement for gender equity, the anti-war movement, all these different environmental movements, World Social Forum. There's just all these manifestations of it, and it's growing every day. We saw the largest, back in mid-February, we saw the largest ever public display of morality when tens of millions of people went out in the streets around the world to say no to the Bush's war. Now, okay, you know, Bush got away with that, but still, what he's doing is he's recruiting people to this movement because he's scaring the hell out of people. So you, the value package of this people's globalization is not money values, it's life values, the life cycle, both people and environment, rather than the money cycle, nonviolence, and God does not take sides in intraspecies conflicts. No matter what your conceptualization of God, whether it's anthropomorphic white guy in a robe up in a cloud or the cycle of life or the life force of the universe or whatever it is, it's not going to take sides in intraspecies conflicts. A battle between red ants and black ants, no God is going to get involved in that. So these guys are, what I see it as, it's the last gasp of fundamentalism, which they took the fun out of fundamentalism. You know, it's the last gasp. It's a dying bull kicks the hardest. It's a paradigm in its death throes, and that's why they're so violent and lashing out. Because, I mean, it's like me with my kids. If I can explain to my kids why they should behave in a certain way, that's certainly superior to beating them into compliance with my norms. And these guys have to use violence because most people in the world don't buy into their policy package. Their whole neoliberal economic agenda has failed. They crashed countries like Argentina. It's a wealthy country with highly educated people, and they wrecked it. They drove it right into the ditch. So the policy failures are replaced with violence and force. And what that tells me is they're doomed. They're going down. What we have to do is we have to build the alternative system that's going to replace it from the grassroots up.
Brooke Hagerty is the co-author of Moving Onward, From Racial Division to Class Unity. She's also a member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. She was interviewed by People's Tribune radio correspondent Sandy Reed in Chicago, Illinois.
Capitalism is an inherently unstable economic system. And we can see that by looking through history, that it's lurched from boom to bust and back again. In the past, this was mainly a matter of overproduction. That's as too many goods being produced for the market to absorb. People were laid off, production was cut back, inventories went down, and eventually people were called back to work and production got going again. Maybe some companies went bankrupt and a smaller number of companies now produce the same amount of goods, or other companies moved in and started taking up that part of the industry. But the main thing is that workers were always needed in the production process, who then, of course, would buy goods and keep the market going with the wages that they got from their jobs. Or another way things got going again was a market was created for goods, like the situation you had in World War II. For several years, the country had been in a terrible depression, but because of the war effort, the government needed jeeps and tanks and planes, etc., and people were put to work to produce those things. And we've all seen that old footage on the History Channel of the workers pouring into the munition plants and the auto factories and into the shipyards to build destroyers and aircraft carriers. The need was so great, the government even put women to work in factories, which of course was not unheard of, but it certainly was unheard of in such numbers. In fact, to allow these women to work for the war effort, the government even created daycare centers, special programs, etc. So it shows what the government can do if it needs to. Hundreds of thousands were put to work, and this, along with the government, of course, being a huge consumer, helped to pull the country out of the depression. Today, we still have this same boom and bust cycle. We're still experiencing that. But the context in which this is taking place is entirely different. Computers and robots and digital technology, all of these are forms of labor replacing technology. That is, they do the work that people used to do. This means that people are not needed in the same ways or in the same numbers that they were in the past. And that's not all. Because these technologies can produce things faster and cheaper, it lowers the value of all human labor. This means that not only do we see unemployment spreading throughout the society, but the value of the labor of those who are working is being steadily driven down as well. So this is also true for blue-collar sectors like manufacturing, but also for white-collar work like managers and workers with specific skills. For example, because of this technology, one white-collar worker can now do the work that would have taken three white-collar workers 10 years ago. And military spending's not going to get us out of it either. Just this year, military spending was increased $98 billion. Now, this is going to help the defense industry, but it's not going to help to provide those much-needed jobs. The defense industry has also made use of labor-replacing technologies, just like every other industry. So they can easily expand their output without either calling back their old workers or hiring new ones. Now, of course, there's some hiring going on in the defense industry, but this is mainly in the higher skilled work, such as sophisticated software and systems engineering. This will benefit a handful of workers, to be sure, but if the rapid advancement of technology in the last 10 years has been any judge, many of these workers will also be made obsolete. And the impact of this technology goes way beyond unemployment. It undermines the capitalist system itself. Capitalism is based on the buying and selling of goods. People have to buy. To buy, they have to have money. To have money, they need to work. When money is the only means of acquiring goods, and work is the only legal means of acquiring money, how are hundreds of millions of people around the world going to buy that ever-growing mountain of goods that robots and automation are producing when they can't work or when the work they get doesn't pay them enough to get by? So we're no longer simply looking at cyclical unemployment and the temporary interruption of the buying and selling of goods. What we're looking at is long-term permanent unemployment and the destruction of the capitalist market. So the capitalists have a big problem, and as usual, of course, they're making it our problem. We all see and experience what's happening around us and can give descriptions of those problems. The deteriorating schools, the crumbling cities, the terrible pollution and ill health we're experiencing, the violence and despair that people feel. I mean, people just can't live, no matter how much they scramble to make ends meet. The recent census figures came out, I think just this year, and they show that poverty is increasing among all groups, white and minority, women and men, and in every region of the country, and in almost every occupational category. And people can't help the capitalists out anymore by spending more, because people are drowning in debt. A recent survey found that household debt is incredible, more than 100% of disposable personal income, and this is the highest level ever. And at the same time, the capitalists are laughing all the way to the bank. They're making billions, and when they get caught doing something illegal to help them make those billions, like they did with Enron or WorldCom, nothing happens to them. Except what happens to the workers is that they lose their jobs, their pensions, and everything they've worked for all their lives. People are working harder than ever for the less and less of what they get. And we're talking about the need to reorganize society around the possibilities of this technology, which doesn't mean that people wouldn't do some kind of work. I think the work that you'd be looking at would be work that would be much more in the interests of society as a whole, where people would contribute to society along the lines of what was necessary and would receive the means to live a decent and stable and cultivated life. So it's not a matter of just a handout. It's a matter of setting the conditions for the kind of society where people can live as human beings. And that's not the kind of society we have now. In a capitalist society, the government exists to protect the interests of the capitalists first. That is to say, to protect their ability to make those maximum profits. This can be done in a direct way, like with specific legislation to help one industry or another. Or it might be legislation that cuts interest rates or pushes through tax cuts or eliminates barriers to investment or gets rid of laws that protects consumers and society. That is anything that hampers their ability to maximize their profit. And even concessions to the workers are done in such a way as to advance the capitalist interests. And I think two important examples where this is happening today is this new education bill that was passed, the No Child Left Behind legislation, and the Medicare reform that the administration is now talking about passing. Well, actually, both the Democrats and the Republicans are talking about passing it and agree upon the basic, you know, aspects of it. But both of these pieces of legislation are being sold as solutions to the problems that people have with education and health care. But in reality, all they are is a means to help further privatize these areas and to open them up as areas for making profits for the capitalists. And, of course, it further undermines the government's responsibility for the well-being of society. And this whole idea of the shift away from government's responsibility for society, I think, gets back to what we were talking about before, which is that with this technology, fewer workers are needed for the production process and to produce the goods of society. And it's no longer in the capitalist interest to provide what they provided for in the past, which is education or social programs, or even the little meager guarantee of health and welfare of the workforce that they provided in the past. Even that is not necessary and actually detracts away from their ability to make their profits. And I think that even deeper than this, the thing that affecting us is that it's directly related to the way that human life has become without any value to the capitalist class. We no longer are valuable to them because we can't produce for them. And so we see this in everything that they're doing. Everything they're doing reflects this. And I think that the current round of budget cuts, there's no better example than that, I think. The politicians are making specific and calculated choices with these budget cuts. They aren't just random choices across the board. They aren't talking about taking away that corporate tax break or taxing the ones who have billions of dollars. No, they're cutting child care or health care for the elderly. The American people don't like these kinds of things. Americans have a very clear sense of right and wrong. And their compass sometimes goes a little haywire, I think, but it's almost a national trait, this sense of right and wrong that Americans have, this sense of fairness, I guess you might say, the idea that everyone deserves a fair shake in life. Polls keep finding that Americans want more money to go into social programs. They want money to be spent on protecting the environment and to providing for those who need it. They want more money spent on public education and health care. Now, it's a fact that most Americans don't understand or realize how much poverty is really out there. The interesting example was the Catholic Campaign for Human Development did a survey this year and found that most Americans believe that there's between 1 and 5 million people living in poverty in the United States, when the actual number is nearly 33 million. So in part, this is why I think people see poverty or economic hard times as a matter of personal failure. Of course, the capitalists spend a lot of time and money on making us think that this is the case. It's almost an industry in itself. You know, this concept of, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, anyone can make it, the promise of America is the opportunity to remake yourself and get rich. And the meaning behind this, of course, is anyone who is poor or struggling is a bad person. The biggest task, I think, facing us is getting the American people to see that their interests are not the same as the capitalists, and they really do have economic rights, and that they have to think about and act upon a vision of society where the majority of people in this country are provided for. This is a big task, particularly given the history of this country. But the economic situation is at least putting the question on the table, and it's up to us who believe in a decent future for all Americans to make sure that question gets taken up. We need something else. We need a society that guarantees that everyone shares in the fruits of society.
That's it for this edition of Dreaming Revolution. Dreaming Revolution is a special presentation of People's Tribune Radio and produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide are used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our print or other audio publications, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888, 1-800-691-6888, or on the internet, www.lrna.org. thanks to everyone who contributed to today's program, particularly David Apsey and Sandy Reed. This program was made possible in part with financial support from the Funding Exchange and the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. My name is Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we'd like to thank you for joining us for this edition of Dreaming Revolution.